The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton Book 2, Chapter 5, Part 2 What that universal yet fighting faith brought into the world was hope. Perhaps the one thing common to mythology and philosophy was that both were really sad, in the sense that they had not this hope, even if they had touches of faith or charity. We may call Buddhism a faith, though to us it seems more like a doubt. We may call the Lord of Compassion a Lord of Charity, though it seems to us a very pessimist sort of pity. But those who insist most on the antiquity and size of such cults must agree that in all their ages they have not covered all their areas with that sort of practical and pugnacious hope. In Christendom, hope has never been absent. Rather, it has been errant, extravagant, excessively fixed upon fugitive chances. Its perpetual revolution and reconstruction has at least been an evidence of people being in better spirits. Europe did very truly renew its youth like the eagles, just as the eagles of Rome rose again over the legions of Napoleon, or we have seen soaring but yesterday the silver eagle of Poland. But in the Polish case, ever revolution went always with religion. Napoleon himself sought a reconciliation with religion. Religion could never be finally separated even from the most hostile of the hopes, simply because it was the very source of the hopefulness. And the cause of this is to be found simply in the religion itself. Those who quarrel about it seldom ever consider it in itself. There is neither space nor place for such a full consideration here. But a word may be said to explain a reconciliation that always recurs, and still seems to require explanation. There will be no end to the weary debates about liberalizing theology until people face the fact that the only liberal part of it is really the dogmatic part. If dogma is incredible, it is because it is incredibly liberal. If it is irrational, it can only be in giving us more assurance of freedom than is justified by reason. The obvious example is that essential form of freedom which we call free will. It is absurd to say that a man shows his liberality in denying his liberty, but it is tenable that he has to affirm a transcendental doctrine in order to affirm his liberty. There is a sense in which we might reasonably say that if man has a primary power of choice, he has in that fact a supernatural power of creation, as if he could raise the dead or give birth to the unbegotten. Possibly in that case a man must be a miracle. And certainly in that case he must be a miracle in order to be a man, and most certainly in order to be a free man. But it is absurd to forbid him to be a free man, and do it in the name of a more free religion. But it is true in 20 other matters. Anybody who believes at all in God must believe in the absolute supremacy of God. But in so far as that supremacy does allow of any degrees that can be called liberal or illiberal, it is self-evident that the illiberal power is the deity of the rationalists, and the liberal power is the deity of the dogmatists. Exactly in proportion as you turn monotheism into monism, you turn it into despotism. It is precisely the unknown God of the scientist, with his impenetrable purpose and his inevitable and unalterable law, that reminds us of a Prussian autocrat making rigid plans in a remote tent and moving mankind like machinery. It is precisely the God of miracles and answered prayers that reminds us of a liberal and popular prince, receiving petitions, listening to parliaments, and considering the cases of a whole people. I am not now arguing the rationality of this conception in other respects. As a matter of fact, it is not, as some suppose, irrational. For there is nothing irrational in the wisest and most well-informed king acting differently according to the action of those he wishes to save. But I am here only noting the general nature of liberality, or of free or enlarged atmosphere of action. And in this respect, it is certain that the king can only be what we call magnanimous, if he is what some call capricious. It is the Catholic who has the feeling that his prayers do make a difference when offered for the living and the dead, who also has the feeling of living like a free citizen in something like, almost like, a constitutional commonwealth. It is the monist who lives under a single iron law, who must have the feeling of living like a slave under a sultan. Indeed, I believe that the original use of the word suffragium, which we now use in politics for a vote, was that employed in theology about a prayer. The dead in purgatory were said to have the suffrages of the living. And in this sense, of a sort of right of petition to the supreme ruler, we may truly say that the whole of the communion of saints, as well as the whole of the church militant, is founded on universal suffrage. But above all, it is true of the most tremendous issue, of that tragedy which has created the divine comedy of our creed. Nothing short of the extreme and strong and startling doctrine of the divinity of Christ will give that particular effect that can truly stir the popular sense like a trumpet. The idea of the king himself serving in the ranks like a common soldier. By making that figure merely human, we make that story much less human. We take away the point of the story, which actually pierces humanity, the point of the story, which was quite literally the point of a spear. It does not especially humanize the universe to say that good and wise men can die for their opinions, any more than it would be any sort of uproariously popular news in an army, that good soldiers may easily get killed. It is no news that King Leonidas is dead, any more than that Queen Anne is dead. And men did not wait for Christianity to be men, in the full sense of being heroes. But if we are describing, for the moment, the atmosphere of what is general and popular and even picturesque, any knowledge of human nature will tell us that no sufferings of the sons of men, or even of the servants of God, strike the same note as the notion of the master suffering instead of his servants. And this is given by the theological, and emphatically not by the scientific deity. No mysterious monarch hidden in his starry pavilion at the base of the cosmic campaign is in the least like that celestial chivalry of the captain who carries his five wounds in the front of the battle. What the denouncer of dogma really means is not that dogma is bad, but rather that dogma is too good to be true. That is, he means that dogma is too liberal to be likely. Dogma gives man too much freedom when it permits him to fall. Dogma gives even God too much freedom when it permits him to die. That is what the intelligent skeptics ought to say, and it is not in the least my intention to deny that there is something to be said for it. They mean that the universe is itself a universal prison, that existence itself is a limitation and a control. And it is not for nothing that they call causation a chain. In a word, they mean simply that they cannot believe these things. Not in the least that they are unworthy of belief. We say lightly, but very literally, that the truth has made us free. They say that it makes us so free that it cannot be the truth. To them it is like believing in fairyland, to believe in such freedom as we enjoy. It is like believing in men with wings, to entertain the fancy of men with wills. It is like accepting a fable about a squirrel in conversation with a mountain, to believe in a man who is free to ask, or a god who is free to answer. This is a manly and a rational negation, for which I, for one, shall always show respect. But I decline to show any respect for those who first of all clip the wings and cage the squirrel, rivet the chains and refuse the freedom, close all the doors of the cosmic prison on us with a clang of eternal iron, tell us that our emancipation is a dream and our dungeon a necessity, and then calmly turn around and tell us that they have a more liberal thought. But I decline to show any respect for those who first of all clip the wings and cage the squirrel, rivet the chains and refuse the freedom, close all the doors of the cosmic prison on us with a clang of eternal iron, tell us that our emancipation is a dream and our dungeon a necessity, and then calmly turn round and tell us they have a freer thought and a more liberal theology. The moral of all this is an old one, that religion is revelation. In other words, it is a vision, and a vision received by faith. But it is a vision of reality. The faith consists in a conviction of its reality. That, for example, is the difference between a vision and a daydream. And that is the difference between religion and mythology. That is the difference between faith and all that fancy work, quite human and more or less healthy, which we considered under the head of mythology. There is something in the reasonable use of the very word vision that implies two things about it. First, that it comes very rarely. Possibly that it comes only once. That it comes once and for all. A daydream may come every day. A daydream may be different every day. It is something more than the difference between telling ghost stories and meeting a ghost. But if it is not a mythology, neither is it a philosophy. It is not a philosophy because, being a vision, it is not a pattern, but a picture. It is not one of those simplifications which resolve everything into an abstract explanation, as that everything is recurrent, or everything is relative, or everything is inevitable, or everything is elusive. It is not a process, but a story. It has proportions of the sort seen in a picture or a story. It has not the regular repetitions of a pattern or a process. But it replaces them by being convincing as a picture or a story is convincing. In other words, it is exactly, as the phrase goes, like life. For indeed it is life. An example of what is meant here might well be found in the treatment of the problem of evil. It is easy enough to make a plan of life of which the background is black, the background is black, as the pessimists do, and then admit a speck or two of stardust more or less accidental, or, at least in the literal sense, insignificant. And it is easy enough to make another plan on white paper, as the Christian scientists do, and explain away, somehow, such dots or smudges as may be difficult to deny. Lastly, it is easiest of all, perhaps, to say, as the dualists do, that life is like a chessboard in which the two are equal, and can as truly be said to consist of white squares as of black, of white squares on a blackboard, or of black squares on a whiteboard. But every man feels in his heart that none of these three paper plans is like life, that none of these worlds is one in which he can live. Something even tells him that the ultimate idea of a world is not bad or even neutral. Staring at the sky or the grass or the truths of mathematics or even a new-laid egg, he has the vague feeling, like the shadow of that saying of the great Christian philosopher St. Thomas Aquinas, every existence as such is good. On the other hand, something tells him that it is unmanly and debased and even diseased to minimize evil to a dot or even a blot. He realizes that optimism is morbid. It is, if possible, even more morbid than pessimism. These vague but healthy feelings, if he followed them out, would result in the idea that evil is, in some way, an exception, but an enormous exception, and ultimately that evil is an invasion, or yet more truly, a rebellion. He does not think that everything is right, or that everything is wrong, or that everything is equally right and wrong. But he does think that right has a right to be right, and therefore a right to be there. And wrong has no right to be wrong, and therefore no right to be there. It is the prince of the world, but it is also a usurper. So he will apprehend vaguely what the vision will give to him vividly, no less than all that strange story of treason in heaven and the great desertion by which evil damaged and tried to destroy a cosmos that it could not create. It is a very strange story, and its proportions and its lines and colors are as arbitrary and absolute as the artistic composition of a picture. It is a vision which we do, in fact, symbolize in pictures by titanic limbs and passionate tints of plumage. All that abysmal vision of falling stars and the peacock panoplies of the night. But that strange story has one small advantage over the diagrams. It is like life. Another example might be found, not in the problem of evil, but in what is called the problem of progress. One of the ablest agnostics of the age once asked me whether I thought mankind grew better, or grew worse, or remained the same. He was confident that the alternative covered all possibilities. He did not see that it only covered patterns and not pictures, processes and not stories. I asked him whether he thought that Mr. Smith of Golders Green got better or worse or remained exactly the same between the ages of 30 and 40. It then seemed to dawn on him that it would rather depend on Mr. Smith and how he chose to go on. It never occurred to him that it might depend on how mankind chose to go on, and that its course was not a straight line, or an upward or downward curve, but a track like that of a man across a valley, going where he liked and stopping where he chose, going into a church or falling down into a ditch. The life of man is a story, an adventure story, and in our vision the same is true even of the story of God. The Catholic faith is the reconciliation, because it is the realization both of mythology and philosophy. It is a story, and in that sense, one of 100 stories. Only it is a true story. It is a philosophy, and in that sense, one of 100 philosophies. Only it is a philosophy that is like life. But above all, it is a reconciliation, because it is something that can only be called the philosophy of stories. That normal narrative instinct which produced all the fairy tales is something that is neglected by all the philosophies, except one. The faith is the justification of that popular instinct. The finding of a philosophy for it, or the analysis of the philosophy in it. Exactly as a man in an adventure story has to pass various tests to save his life, so the man in this philosophy has to pass several tests and save his soul. In both, there is an idea of free will operating under conditions of design. In other words, there is an aim, and it is the business of a man to aim at it. We therefore watch to see whether he will hit it. Now, this deep and democratic and dramatic instinct is derided and dismissed in all the other philosophies. For all the other philosophies, avowedly end where they begin. And it is the definition of a story that it ends differently, that it begins in one place and ends in another. From Buddha and his wheel to Akhenaten and his disc, from Pythagoras with his abstraction of number to Confucius with his religion of routine, there is not one of them that does not in some way sin against the soul of a story. There is none of them that really grasps this human notion of the tale, the test, the adventure, the ordeal of the free man. Each of them starves the storytelling instinct, so to speak, and does something to spoil human life considered as a romance, whether by fatalism, pessimist or optimist, and that destiny that is the death of adventure, or by indifference, and that detachment that is the death of drama, or by a fundamental skepticism that is the death of drama, or by a fundamental skepticism that dissolves the actors into atoms, or by a materialistic limitation blocking the vista of moral consequences, or a mechanical recurrence making even moral tests monotonous, or a bottomless relativity making even practical tests insecure. There is such a thing as a human story, and there is such a thing as the divine story, which is also a human story. But there is no such thing as a Hegelian story, or a monist story, or a relativist story, or a determinist story. For every story, yes, even a penny dreadful or a cheap novelette, has something in it that belongs to our universe and not theirs. Every short story does truly begin with creation and end with a last judgment. And that is the reason why the myths and the philosophers were at war until Christ came. That is why the Athenian democracy killed Socrates out of respect for the gods, and why every strolling sophist gave himself the airs of a Socrates whenever he could talk of, in a superior fashion, of the gods, and why the heretic pharaoh wrecked his huge idols and temples for an abstraction, and why the priests could return in triumph and trample his dynasty underfoot, and why Buddhism had to divide itself from Brahmanism, and why in every age and country outside Christendom there has been a feud forever between the philosopher and the priest. It is easy enough to say that the philosopher is generally the more rational. It is easier still to forget that the priest is always the more popular. For the priest told the people stories, and the philosopher did not understand the philosophy of stories. It came into the world with the story of Christ. And this is why it had to be a revelation or a vision given from above. Anyone who will think of the theory of stories or pictures will easily see the point. The true story of the world must be told by somebody to somebody else. By the very nature of a story, it cannot be left to occur to anybody. A story has proportions, variations, surprises, particular dispositions, which cannot be worked out by rule in the abstract, like a sum. We could not deduce whether or not Achilles would give back the body of Hector from a Pythagorean theory of number or recurrence. And we could not infer for ourselves in what way the world would get back the body of Christ, merely from being told that all things go round and round upon the wheel of Buddha. A man might perhaps work out a proposition of Euclid without having heard of Euclid, but he would not work out the precise legend of Eurydice without having heard of Eurydice. At any rate, he would not be certain how the story would end, and whether Orpheus was ultimately defeated. Still less could he guess the end of our story, or the legend of our Orpheus rising, not defeated, from the dead. To sum up, the sanity of the world was restored, and the soul of man offered salvation, by something which did indeed satisfy the two warring tendencies of the past, which had never been satisfied in full, and most certainly never satisfied together. It met the mythological search for romance by being a story, and the philosophical search for truth by being a true story. That is why the ideal figure had to be a historical character, as nobody had ever felt Adonis or Pan to be a historical character. But that is also why the historical character had to be the ideal figure, and even fulfill many of the functions given to these other ideal figures. Why he was at once the sacrifice and the feast, why he could be shown under the emblems of the growing vine or the rising sun. The more deeply we think of the matter, the more we shall conclude that if there be indeed a God, his creation could hardly have reached any other culmination than this granting of a real romance to the world. Otherwise, the two sides of the human mind could never have touched at all, and the brain of man would have remained cloven and double, one lobe of it dreaming impossible dreams, and the other repeating invariable calculations. The picture-makers would have remained forever painting the portrait of nobody. The sages would have remained forever adding up numerals that came to nothing. It was that abyss that nothing but an incarnation could cover, a divine embodiment of our dreams. And he stands above that chasm, whose name is more than priest, and older even than Christendom. Pontifex Maximus, the mightiest maker of a bridge. But even with that, we return to the more specially Christian symbol in the same tradition, the perfect pattern of the keys. This is a historical and not a theological outline, and it is not my duty here to defend in detail that theology, but merely to point out that it could not even be justified in design without being justified in detail, like a key. Beyond the broad suggestion of this chapter, I attempt no apologetic about why the creed should be accepted. But in answer to the historical query of why it was accepted and is accepted, I answer for millions of others in my reply. Because it fits the lock. Because it is like life. It is one among many stories. Only it happens to be a true story. It is one among many philosophies. Only it happens to be the truth. We accept it, and the ground is solid under our feet, and the road is open before us. It does not imprison us in a dream of destiny or a consciousness of the universal delusion. It opens to us not only incredible heavens, but what seems to some an equally incredible earth, and makes it credible. This is the sort of truth that is hard to explain, because it is a fact. But it is a fact to which we can call witnesses. We are Christians and Catholics, not because we worship a key, but because we have passed a door and felt the wind that is the trumpet of liberty blow over the land of the living. End of Book 2, Chapter 5.